Hi guys. Oh wow. So I was telling Chris earlier, I've never done this before. I've never shared my entire story before with bits and pieces all over the place. So if I jump all over the place, I apologize now. I'm going to try really hard not to do that. But my name is Chelsea, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. And what that means for me is that I have not had a drink or used an illicit street drug. It's September 27th, 2018, or according to my lovely little thing on my phone, 2 years. Oh, you can't see it. 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days today. I'm a big numerology sort of person, so all the twos lining up is like a weird thing for me. I guess so. To start from the beginning, I was born in Plano, Texas, and I was raised in North Garland. Sort of the North Garland, Richardson, Plano-esque sort of area. My mom and dad were next door neighbors. They met when they were, I think, like 13 and 15, and ended up getting married 4 years later, having me 4 years after that. So I was very much in the plan for a minute. My family was, my mom and dad's, were high school sweethearts, all of that good stuff. My grandparents were next door neighbors. So that was essentially my mom and dad when they divorced, my mom's first divorce, mind you. When I was two, I was essentially raised by my dad's parents for the most part. My brother, I have a younger brother who is a year and a half younger. His name is Jeremy. He was mostly raised by my mom's parents. So essentially, but we were next door, if that makes any sense. Because when my parents divorced, my dad took on a lot more. He's a mechanic. He went back to school for that. And also, well, they both basically fell into their own addictions. We'll start that way. Sorry, I have a cat, y'all. My dad, his thing was meth. So that began pretty heavily, like early on when I was younger. Been in and out of prison 3 times that I recall growing up. So we were essentially, my mom was the sole caregiver, even though we were raised from my grandparents, I guess, for the first, I don't know, I would say maybe 7 or 8 years until Jeremy and I could basically take care, stay home on our own and raise ourselves. That's essentially how that worked out because my mom worked all the time. That was her addiction, basically. She fell into working constant hours. And so Jeremy and I basically just learned to take care of one another. And that was pretty much how we just stayed to ourselves for the most part. Jeremy very much became the one that was super active and involved in sports and things of that nature. I became super heavily involved with my academics and I ran with school. That was my thing. I found solace in that. I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety at a pretty young age. And for whatever reason, school actually helped me kind of get out of that and out of myself a little bit. So that was always my forte, although it didn't help with my isolation at all because I just stayed by myself and did projects, right? But even before any of my own addictions started, I didn't really pay much attention to the fact that they did run in my family. My mom also was in and out of marriages. She's working on her sixth now. But I was always the black sheep before any of my addictions actually started. I had nothing in common with my family. I did my own thing. I was very involved with, like I said, school and learning, and I loved the arts of any capacity. I loved music. I loved museums, ballets, things of that nature. My family was very much the opposite, super conservative, and very like they loved NASCAR and doing things like that. And we just, for me, I was very much just alone for a really long time. And I just thought that was normal, to be honest with you. So I grew up pretty awkward, and just involved with all like the cultural, artistic sort of stuff that I just found comfort in, really, sort of an escape for me. music, like I said, was a really big influence. So I went to a lot of shows growing up. And I was pretty good at school and academics. I was usually like a straight A student up until high school. I did all the things in the clubs and whatever that I was essentially the last person I think that anyone would expect to become an alcoholic or an addict is basically, I guess, what I'm trying to get at. It very much surprised my family, very much surprised all of their friends. But it did happen. Like I said, up until my senior year in high school, I was a straight A student. I did all the things. I was Miss Name and Forest at my high school, sort of stuff, like all of that. My senior year, however, was the first time I ever took a drink. And I didn't just take a drink. This should have been a red flag then. It was not for me. It was New Year's, and I recall it was over a boy because I was also very codependent when I was growing up. We'll get to more of that later. But my opinion of myself was very much rooted in how other people saw me, especially members of the opposite sex. So when this particular boy, who happened to be like a best friend that I thought I was in love with, right, high school, whatever, we had had sort of a falling out this New Year's Eve. I recall I went and I bought a 6-pack of Mike's Hard Cranberries because that's what all the girls drank. And that's what everyone told me that I would really enjoy. They did not, however, tell me that it did not mix well with other liquors, which I did partake in throughout the night since it was New Year's. There's shots of tequila, screwdrivers, vodka, whatever. By the end of the night, I was throwing up red everywhere. And it was a terrible experience for me. But that didn't deter me. That was my first experience with drinking. And that honestly was just like, okay, in my mind, I was like, we just overdid it. Next time you need to course correct, right? Because that was what everyone did. So I started, that was the beginning of my drinking. I continued to drink like my senior year on and off just at parties. And I became social and I was around more people and that loneliness and that isolation went away. So I thought that was my solution to a lot of things, and it made me more likable for people. It made me want to get out and talk to people and do things that weren't just my nose in a book sort of thing. It got to the point where I started surrounding myself with people, and this would be a theme throughout my lifetime, people who drank heavily but could handle their drinking. I was not one of those people, although it was unbeknownst to me at the time. My senior year, I started skipping school because I was fortunate enough to be in AP classes where I had teachers say, this is a college course. We're going to teach you like it's a college course. You don't have to show up if you don't want to, but if you start missing tests and whatever, that's on you. So I did skip a lot of school so that I could go essentially drink and party with these people. Thought that was the better choice at the moment. So much so that I didn't pay attention to like an attendance policy or specific grades in one particular class. And I didn't end up graduating with my class because I was gone so much the second semester of my senior year. And that was a pretty big 180 from going from like a straight A student to all of a sudden just missing consistent classes and not being able to graduate. It still did not resonate really with me. It was more like, oh, well, I can't walk the stage. I just have to take a summer class for a month and then I'll graduate, which I did. And so it still didn't really register to me that there was any sort of anything wrong. I just thought that was normal high school behavior, to be honest, that I was finally catching up to. After that, I enrolled in college, and I also became a bartender at the same time. I had waited tables a little bit before, but I had started bartending at a restaurant downtown in downtown Dallas. And when I did that, I was also going to school at Richland Community College. I barely made it through my first semester. I think I made an A, two Bs, and a C, which is crazy to me that that even exists. Like, and I'm usually the kind of person that like does not do well with without getting A's. So the fact that I was just okay with those grades should have, again, been another red flag. But and one of those grades was actually from a psychology course where I had missed so many classes that they said, you have to, your grade would have been an A, but because of our attendance policy, I'm giving you a B. And so I was, of course, justifying my behavior all sorts of ways. You know, like, I don't understand what the problem is. Like, obviously, I can still make an A and not go to class. I don't see what your issue is. It's always, you were always the problem. I was never at fault. And that was pretty common for a lot of my life, to be honest. Cut to, you know, like my, also my first year, actually prior to my first year, this is the skipping around, I apologize. The first night I learned to beer bong was also coincidentally known as the night I lost my virginity to a friend raping me. And that actually still to this day is a little bit hard for me to say, because for so long, I basically told myself it was my fault because I had put myself in that situation. And there was a lot of stuff that I had to do around that. But that was, and again, all of these situations are things that you would have thought I would have been smart enough, because obviously academically I was pretty smart. You would have thought I was smart enough, common sense wise, to say, this is clearly a fucking problem for you and it is putting you in these situations. Maybe you should not be associating yourself with this sort of stuff, right? And it didn't. That was basically just the tip of the iceberg, right? And I would like to say that that first experience was the only experience that I've ever had like that, but it was just one of many, to the point where I honestly have lost track, if I'm being honest. That was basically after my first semester in high or in college. I enrolled in a bunch more classes, never bothered to go to class, and never bothered to drop those classes either. So I had a lot of F's on my transcript for a long time, actually. Still to this day, actually, there's I don't know, somewhere like 18 hours worth of F's that I had to retake when I went back to school. But at the time, the idea of me bettering myself was always there, but I couldn't grasp the concept of I couldn't do it while I was actively drinking to the extent that I was drinking. And I drank pretty heavily pretty early on. Being a bartender, it justified my behaviors damn near every day. When customers would buy me shots, it was just part of the job. You know, that was, it raised your tab. It got me a bigger tip. That was ultimately my job. And every job I've ever had in the restaurant industry has always pretty much encouraged that behavior because it helped their sales too, to be honest. So I did that for a while up until I was, I guess, 22-ish. I was working a crap ton of hours in a restaurant and got my first DUI on St. Patrick's Day when I was 22. And again, was not actually all that drunk. And I was going to pick up friends from Plano, actually, because they were staying the night at my new apartment and somehow ended up there. I went to go get them and got pulled over. And again, it was all justification in my mind or just, it's because it was St. Patrick's Day. I'm 22. This is a bigger deal than it should be, you know. But I did serve, you know, I did the probation and all of that good stuff. And I never took it to heart. It was basically like, this is what 22-year-olds do, right? So after a while, though, I was working a lot of hours and really frustrated with that. And my family was so frustrated with me, too, not getting what they called a big kid job. So I did essentially start working for a law firm in downtown Dallas. And I thought maybe that change of scenery would also help, as far as my addiction problem went. It did not. I will tell you that I worked for that law firm for several years, and it actually, truthfully, the culture behind that made it much worse. We were privy to a lot of happy hours, a lot of late night partying, and that was where I was first introduced to cocaine. And that was, I didn't do it quite a lot then. It actually took a little while when I decided that I was done with what I called my Great Gatsby years, like the parties and the fancy dinners and all of that stuff became not glamorous anymore. I decided I wanted to go back to waiting tables again and try and figure things out. So I got a job at a bar in Frisco, where I was equally miserable, but I met a boy named Dusty who I thought I was in love with. He's 10 years older than me. He was a bartender there, of course. And he had a very serious cocaine problem. Sorry, my cat, y'all. And that became the norm for us because, like I said, my validation, I needed validation from the opposite sex. My worth was very much in directly tied to who I was dating, who I was sleeping with, and their opinion of me. And he would get angry if I wouldn't partake. And so I did. Like, I very much would just be like, if it will make you like me more, this will be our bonding experience. Right. And what a fucked up thing that is to say now, I know. Sorry about my language, y'all. But it's true. That was my norm. And for a couple of years, I thought that was what love was, right? It wasn't, obviously, or I've learned that since. But yeah, in the meantime, like, Dusty and I had ended horribly. I ended up splitting up with him and getting another job and getting involved with, at that point, I had been in the mindset of like, love doesn't really exist. Infatuation very much did still for me. So I was one of those people that just became like, I will sleep with whoever is providing me with all the drugs and alcohol at this point in time. Like in my mind, I was so delusional to think that I was the one manipulating you into those situations, right? I think it was very much a trade-off now. But I had gotten involved with two different bartenders when I was 23, 24, and ended up pregnant for the first time. I did not realize, or I didn't know which one of them would be the father. That terrified me. And on top of that, I did not want to let go of my lifestyle. That I was very much in this place where I told myself I was choosing these things and it wasn't a problem. So I had an abortion, which would take its toll on me probably 6 months later. But at the time, I thought that was absolutely my only option. That was the only thing I wanted to do. So I did have an abortion. About 6 months after that, though, that's when it hit really hard for me. And my depression and anxiety went through the roof. And I started numbing myself with damn near everything, mostly drinking, though. And that progressed into just, it wasn't even a choice anymore. It was just what I did every day. I woke up and I didn't want to feel, so I didn't. I just continued that lifestyle for kind of a while, up until my second DUI, which was, I want to say I was 27 at the time. I'm 36 now. It's 27. I was 26, I guess, when I got the DUI. I had flipped my car. Backstory, I've been in and out of hospitals for alcohol poisoning throughout all of this, by the way, none of that deterred me. And I had flipped my Jeep with my second DUI. It had rolled 7 times. The entire top half had collapsed in on me. I don't remember any of it other than leaving the bar after basically drinking like a bottle of Rumplements. But when I came to in the hospital, they said I had like a 0.42 BAC, and that I was lucky to be alive because the top of my card caved in. And the fucked up part, they told me that because the top of my card caved in and because I had drank so much, my initial reaction wasn't to freeze like a normal person. It was just to go limp. And that's what essentially saved my life. And I internalized that is, if I hadn't been drinking, I would be dead. That was not supposed to have been the takeaway at all that they were trying to get through to me. But in my mind, I was like, oh, okay, so you're telling me that good job? I don't know. Like, it was just, that was my way of thinking, was very much always very twisted, especially when it came to my addictions, right? So that became a thing. I was put back on probation and I got a lovely piece of jewelry as my, well, as we all know, is an ankle monitor. So I wore that for a while, and I had gotten really good actually at figuring out just how much I could drink with that. Because you are not that I recommend it, but there was a way to figure out just how much would be in your system for how long. And if you do that math, you can. And I did for months, until one day it just wasn't enough and I went balls to the wall with it. And so my probation was revoked and I was sent to Christian Farms Treehouse, which is a Christian inpatient, 90-day inpatient outside of Waco in Temple, Texas. And I was never, I was raised Southern Baptist, but I am not and have not been, religious for quite some time. So that was a very odd experience for me because it is a very religious place. Or at least at the time I went, it was. And basically about 2 months into it, I wasn't following the rule. I was kind of introduced to the steps there, more so introduced into church. And that was not for me. But I did not know that I had a choice in my recovery at the time. It was very much like, this is what you're expected to do. I did not do it very well. In fact, it, like I said, about 2 months in, it came to me and said, like, if you don't start playing by the rules, essentially, we're going to keep you here longer. So I just learned to shut up and do what I was told until I was gone. But that did keep me sober for 3 months because I was in an inpatient. When I left, I told them when we were making plans to leave that I did not want to go back to Dallas because I knew everyone had always told me you need to change your people, places, things, and or get rid of all the negative people, places, things is more so what they were stressing. Right. No one had ever bothered to tell me that those things needed to be replaced with positive people, places, and things. So while I was busy cutting out people left and right from my life, I was left really isolated and lonely again. And I specifically said I did not want to go back to Dallas for that reason, because those were all the associations I knew. And they said, I remember they said, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to move to Portland or I want to move to Austin. And they said, Portland is a very big heroin city, so we're not going to let you go there, which made no sense to me because I've never done heroin. But I said, okay, well then Austin. And they said, absolutely not. Austin is a very big party drinking city. You will never stay sober in Austin. And so this was, like I said, when I was 27-ish, somewhere in there. So I moved back to Dallas and I moved in with my mom and I isolated. I stayed indoors for 4 months. I never saw people. I occasionally went out to the rooms there to try AA meetings, but I never fit in at any of the groups there. And for me, that was all I knew recovery to be. And so I was very much left with this place of like, what's the point? So I stayed sober for 7 months, if you're tracking that, 3 months in the inpatient, 4 months at my mom's. And I say sober because I'm very big on stressing that sobriety and recovery are two totally different things. So I eventually went back out, surrounded myself with same people. I had met a boy in rehab, however, who I he and I stayed friends for like a year and eventually ended up dating and moving to Austin with him. And that's how I came to Austin some 8 years ago, maybe. When we were here, he also went back to drinking, and he was more of the pill situation, so surrounded myself a lot with that and became one of those people that, like, again, I would take anything if you gave it to me. And we would drink together because that was our bonding. That was, again, my view of love or whatever. I got pregnant for the second time. And I miscarried 16 weeks in. He took that extremely hard. I mean, we both took it extremely hard. He took it to the point where he tried to kill himself. I found him. It was a whole ordeal where he was on a psychiatric hold for quite some time after that in the hospital. We tried to make it work after that, and there was just no making it work, mostly because he resented the hell out of me for losing that baby. And the reason he did, and the reason I resented myself for that, was because I drank through that pregnancy. And I made those choices. And that was something that really, really fucked with me for a while. And again, led me back into when he and I tried to make it work, it didn't work. He moved to Denver. I stayed in Austin and moved to the Salvation Army, actually, because I didn't have a place to go, but I didn't want to leave this city. So I was essentially at this point homeless, broken, and horribly depressed, living downtown. I think I stayed there for several months. And I had actually enrolled at Austin Recovery as in the outpatient classes because I thought, let's try something different. But I never got far enough away from my addiction to actually finish those classes or to actually, you know, really piece together what I wanted to do or what recovery even looked like or could look like for me, to be honest. It was just, for me, I thought the tasks were just too insurmountable. So cut to, I guess, on and off, I ended up leaving the Salvation Army because I had a friend who said, you can't live there anymore. Come stay with me. She's also in her own addictions. But it was a place to stay. So I did, and eventually surrounded myself with quite a lot of drug dealers. That had become my life for so long that I had just gotten so tired and miserable. And I prayed damn near every night that God would fix it somehow. You know, that's, I call my higher power God. I'm not religious, but that's what I refer to my higher power as. So I'd pray every night to God just to make it end, either to give me the strength to find a way out of it or to just have me not wake up in the morning. Essentially, I wanted one of those two options to happen every day. And I kept waking up. So I was like, oh, goddamn. All right. So eventually I started working at a restaurant because those jobs were easy to get in my addiction. I started working with a guy who lived at a place called Oxford House, or he lived in an Oxford House. I had no idea what sober living was. I had no idea what an Oxford House was or anything along those lines. But he basically said, if you ever need a safe place to stay, you can come stay essentially with me. I didn't know that this was against the rules, obviously, at the time, but he was like, you can come stay with me. That's fine. And so when I did, I would stay over at the guy's house and I would notice that they had this community with one another. And I realized that that was something that was missing for me. And so I moderated. I participated in a little bit of harm reduction for a few months. Until I finally got to the point where I said, I think I want to stop. And he was my person that said, I will take you to the hospital, whenever you're ready. Right. I had previously, I should have mentioned, when I was at the Salvation Army, I tried to stop one other time on my own, and I was hospitalized for 8 days for delirium tremens because I was that progressively bad. Like, I physically could not just stop. And that was the scariest place I think I've ever been, is not being able to trust my own mind. So I did, go to Del Seton. He finally took me to Del Seton and I talked to the doctors and said, look, this is what I want. I want to stop completely. And he said, Okay, we'll put you on naltrexone. We'll have you taper off of that for a week. In the meantime, try finding a plan. You're on the right path, but change of scenery, all of those things, right? And I can't tell you exactly what clicked in me that day to make that decision to go that day to change things that day, but I did because there was no law enforcement involved this time. It was not my family pleading with me to go do something. It was just I was done. And so I went, and when I was they had given me a prescription for naltrexone, and said, "Come back in the morning, it'll be ready for you at 8 o'clock." So I got back at 8 o'clock. I said, "It's not ready yet. We need you to sit and wait." So I was waiting in the lobby. My friend who had come with me, Lee, said, "That's my friend Bree. She's working in the coffee shop here. She also lives in Oxford. We should go talk to her." So we did. And this girl said, "We just flipped a house," which I have no idea what that meant. She said, there's vacancies at this house up north if you want to go, if you want a safe place to live." So I moved into sober living that day. Same day I got sober, moved into sober living. I had never known anything about sober living. I had never known, like I said, what recovery looked like, other than I had just made this big decision and that's whatever, right? I thought I couldn't be any worse off. So I moved in, and it terrified me to live with a bunch of other women because I had never done that before and I didn't really know how to trust them. But the house that I had moved into was about a mile from North Austin 24, which would later become my home group. So from the very beginning, I just started, instead of sitting around having uncomfortable conversations with women that I would later get to, in the beginning, I walked to NA24. I walked a mile to that place there and back every day and just sat in the rooms and I listened. And it dawned on me that I had already taken steps 1 through 3 before I had ever even showed up to really start working those steps. But the addition of those steps, and then that's where I really started to find my community, the one that I was talking about, that I think is so, cannot tell you how important that is. So I started surrounding myself with people, men and women, mostly women though, that pushed me to be better and to do better, and that challenged my views on things, and that embraced me for all my fucked up flaws and all of my weird shit, and basically just said, we're here for you no matter what. And they have been. I have a really strong sponsor today who, if I can't talk to for whatever reason, it's not even just my sponsor. I can go to my grand sponsor, my great grand sponsor, my great great grand sponsor. We all are very, very close. We have a very strong support group of women that we bounce ideas off of, and I could not be more grateful for that today. But in the meantime, that helped me to open up to the women in my sober house and to get an idea of what that looked like. And then people started pushing me into the idea of service work, which was a really big thing for me. That was probably one of the biggest things. As far as I started volunteering with Oxford, doing house positions at first, then chapter positions, I started doing fundraising. And that connected me to, I did service work with my home group as well. And then, but the fundraising in particular with Oxford, I had an outreach worker. That's the word I was looking for, named Sean Johnson, who essentially put me in touch with this place, Communities for Recovery, because they needed help with some fundraising stuff. And I said, sure, I love doing it, sure. And I also needed something to fill my time because I am one of those people that very much, if I don't do anything in moderation, if you can't tell. So if it's not me doing a bunch of terrible things, I try to take on a lot of positive things now. So I signed up to be a volunteer and started leading meetings there and helped out with fundraising. So essentially I got involved with Communities for Recovery. And when I did that though, it opened my eyes to a few things. One, that I could do more. So I enrolled in school again, some 16 years later. And I have actually just now finished my first entire year of being back in school, all 3 semesters, fall, spring, summer classes with a 4.0 GPA. I have retaken all of those Fs. I have gotten back on track and I found a passion for what I really want to do, which is social work. And I mostly did that or found that from being involved with all of the volunteer work that I did and helping others and how that, seeing how that affected me and my mood and bettered me truthfully as a person. Today I get to, well, the other thing that Communities for Recovery opened my eyes to was the idea of what a peer recovery coach was, which is what I am now. I took the training, became a peer coach, and now today my life looks a lot like I get to work with various populations, but the one I work most closely with now is with women and children who are involved with the Family Drug Treatment Court program. And that is not my lived experience. As I said, I've never had kids, so I've never had a CPS case, but I'm a firm believer that there are no coincidences anymore, and that my higher power and God puts me in places and situations, whether I realize it at the time or not, that I need to be in and that there's going to be some growth for me in. And for me, oh, I guess also backtrack. When I first started volunteering with Communities for Recovery leading meetings, it was actually for Family Drug Treatment Court before I became a peer coach. It was for court downtown. I would lead a meeting called Awake before their docket every Thursday. And subsequently, at the same time, I became a house manager for the program as well. So I did that for a year, managing women and children for this program. And the reason all of that is so important to me is, like I said, it's not my lived experience. But it was a way for God, I think, to put something into my life that helped me process all of the loss and trauma that I had from my own personal losses surrounding, you know, all the pregnancies. And that has been, I mean, it's just, it amazes me to this day that I can wake up every single morning and that I may not know it at the moment, but later on, it's almost always revealed to me pretty soon, and where I can go, I see God in this. I see where this is. I'm going to get emotional about it now. That this is where I need to be. I knew this was going to happen. I'm glad I came prepared. But yeah, so to this day, like it's just crazy that to me, had I not gone through all of those experiences, had I not, and that wasn't even really all of it, but we don't have a million hours, but had I not gone through all of that, I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in today. I wouldn't be surrounded by the people that I'm with today. I wouldn't have gained this immense amount of respect for myself and for other people. I wouldn't have figured out what love really truly is. And the biggest part for me with that was learning how to figure out how to love myself again, or even to begin with, because I don't know that I ever did. And that is where all of this craziness has led me. It started with the rooms, and then now I get to advocate for people who are also in those places, right? Where I can sit down and say, I remember that darkness. I very vividly remember all of those situations. But it's not the end. It doesn't have to be the end. It could be your jumping off point too. So yeah. Sure, there's a lot of things that I left out in there, but that's kind of the gist of where I got to be to where I am today. Thanks for letting me share that.
Thank you, Chelsea.
Chelsea, that was amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chelsea. You did great. That was awesome.
But Chelsea, you talked some about grades, and I want to tell you, you got an A+ for that presentation.
Oh, thank you.